You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although corporate espionage can be found in almost every industry and in every corner of the globe, it's remained a largely hidden activity. In his book, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, investigative reporter Eamon Javers exposes the secret global network of private spies who gather intelligence for major corporations, Wall Street firms, hedge funds, and foreign governments. Eamon Javers, who covers the White House and the economy for Politico, visited our show in February to discuss the world of corporate espionage. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed our conversation, and we thought we would air it for you again on this Memorial Day. We began by talking about the first spy he ever met, and I asked him who was Nick Day.
Nick Day is an ex-British MI5 officer. That's a British intelligence agency. And when I met him, he was in his late 30s, and he had retired from government service working for the British government and had set off on his own with a partner named Mike Baker, who was a veteran of the U.S. CIA. And the two of them had put together a private spy firm called Diligence.
And were they open about what they were doing?
They were not very open about what they were doing. I had stumbled into their firm. I'm a political reporter, Washington guy, and not really exposed to the world of intelligence at all. But there was a lawsuit between KPMG, the global accounting firm, and Diligence, the private spy firm. And I was investigating the lawsuit and ultimately ended up meeting with Nick, who's a very dashing fellow, and later Mike Baker, to talk about their firm Diligence and what these private spy firms are, how they operate, and just who they're selling their services to.
And is it typical for somebody from MI5 to get together with somebody from CIA? Did they hang out together before they left their spy network?
They did. They tell me that they met each other after they had left their respective spy services, but there's a sort of small fraternity of intelligence operatives around the world, and the Brits and the Americans work very closely together.
How does one start a corporate intelligence agency? Do you put together an IPO to find investors?
Well, these are usually fairly small firms. Sometimes they're just one-man bands, and sometimes they range in size. But in the case of Nick and Mike, they sort of hung out a shingle. They were very, very small, five or six people.
When you say hang out a shingle, what does that mean? The minute you announce that you're in the corporate spying business, you're revealing what you do, aren't you?
That's right. And they have to be, relatively open about it. But it's usually done with a lot of sort of code words and verbiage. So on the Diligence website, which is, up and you can go and look at it, you'll see a lot of things in this industry. They call themselves risk mitigation consultants. They call themselves due diligence investigators and litigation analysis. There's a lot of different sort of industry-friendly buzzwords, but basically in most of those cases it means spying, private detective work.
And I assume that if I needed somebody to do this, I would be able to read those buzzwords. I'd understand the jargon.
Right. The people who are in the business know what that means and know where to go to find these kind of services.
And I'm also assuming that they hire people they knew from when they worked for the CIA or some other spy agency.
Right. So a lot of the spy agencies that I've found, and what I found is in doing the story about Diligence and then later learning about all of these other firms just like that that are throughout the world and throughout the global economy, they tend to sort of be clustered around one sort of expertise. So you get ex-CIA guys in one firm. There's a bunch of firms which have ex-FBI law enforcement types. There was a firm that I talk about in the book that was all ex-U.S. Secret Service were the core of that firm. And they, each one sort of practicing their own thing. So you have satellite jockeys who do satellite surveillance, and you have wiremen who do, computer hacking. And based on their specialty, they sort of aggregate.
So it isn't as competitive as one might imagine because they all specialize so much.
They do, but it is very competitive. And in some of these cases where you have these big, titanic, global corporate struggles, you get an array of spy firms hired on both sides. So you do get a very surreal sort of spy versus spy thing where the firms themselves are spying on each other to keep ahead of what the other side is up to.
Didn't Diligence get burned by doing business with Enron?
Well, they did business with Enron. And one of the things that I talk about in the book a little bit is this very fascinating operation that they had where Mike Baker, the veteran CIA officer, was flying aerial surveillance missions for Enron before that firm obviously collapsed as a spectacular failure. Remember, Enron was an energy trader, and what they needed was information about the energy markets that they could get a jump on before the competition. So they hired Diligence, and Mike Baker used his sort of CIA expertise and said, what we'll do is we'll fly these surveillance missions in Europe looking at power plants. And so they were flying around looking at the power plants, looking to see if they could spot when those power plants were going to be taken offline for annual maintenance. Because when a power plant is shut down for any period of time, the supply of energy in the market goes down, and therefore, as we know from Econ 101, the price goes up. And if they knew that date in advance, just by observing the activity at the plant, they could get a jump on the energy price and make a fortune.
I would assume that's legal.
There's nothing illegal about that. And Mike, you know, said that when they did this, they filed their flight plan with the local governments. They hired local pilots in each of these towns. Companies do aerial surveillance all the time, particularly in real estate, anything where you're dealing with trying to get a measurement of a piece of land. You know, you take a picture of it from the air. But the CIA guys have the ability to look at things in just a slightly different way and say, I know how we can make money based on looking at what we can see visually.
But I'd also assume that the rules sometimes get bent or blurred.
They do. And there's some question about, you know, exactly what is legal and what is not legal in this business. For example, the whole area of dumpster diving, that's when you go rifling through the trash to find documents. There are different jurisdictions around the world which have different laws about that. Generally, my understanding is in the United States, if you put trash out to the curb or some publicly accessible way and you're disposing of that, you're signaling that that's no longer private to you. And so it's not illegal for somebody to come along and swipe your trash and go rifling through. And if you have credit card receipts or documents relating to your business, those can all be very interesting to a spy who's looking to put together a piece of how your business operates.
I guess people assume that if they shredded the document, it was okay. Nobody would ever be able to do anything, but you could put it together like a crossword puzzle.
Yeah.
Maybe now people have to burn all of the documents.
Burn before reading. There's one scene in the book where I talk about this sort of epic spy battle between Nestle and Mars, the two chocolate companies. And in there, the Mars people were, you know, trying to be as secretive and secure as they could, and they were shredding their documents. But what they were doing was shredding the documents and then putting all of the shreds in the same waste paper basket and then throwing those waste paper baskets into the dumpster. When the spies later came along to collect those baskets, all of the shreds were there together in one place. And through painstaking work, they were able to reconstruct those documents. If there's enough money on the line, you know, people will go to real extremes.
My guess is Eamon Javers, J-A-V-E-R-S. His book, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage. Why were Mars and Nestle's two candy giants, but I would assume that they pretty much know what each other is doing. Why would they be spying on each other?
Yeah, it was fascinating to me. This was an incident that happened back in the 1990s. Nestle had developed its own new product. They were going to put together little plastic toys and chocolate balls into one chocolate toy combo, and it was sort of the holy grail of the chocolate industry. If you could combine toys and chocolate together, you could have a huge seller. And it's a really mature industry where there's not much additional market share. There's not much growth. Chocolate sells what it sells. And so if one
company... That's why they fight over whether they buy Cadbury or not.
That's right. And so one company has a huge hit. That comes right out of the hide of the other company, which is now going to sell less. So Mars was very concerned that this Nestle product was going to be a monster hit and eat Mars's lunch, basically. And so they were running an operation, typical corporate operation, where they had lobbyists in Washington going to the FDA and trying to make the case that this was unsafe. The children would choke on these little plastic toys if they were mixed up with chocolate, and it would be dangerous. They hired consultants. The consultants were reaching out to some of the nonprofit, consumer, liberal groups in Washington, trying to convince them that this was a danger to America's children and that they should mobilize against this product. They're trying to leverage everything they could in Washington to shut it down, including an operative that they nicknamed Deep Chocolate, who was an anonymous Mars operative. No one could figure out on the Nestle side who it was, who was going to issue.
This was a mole.
It was a guy who was going to group after group in Washington, trying to get them fired up and get them to start working against Nestle.
They call him Deep Chocolate.
His name was Deep Chocolate after Deep Throat, the famous source. And Nestle was obsessed with trying to figure out who Deep Chocolate was in real life and what his agenda was and who was paying him. And so the spies that were on the Nestle side, Nestle hired a PR firm in Washington, which in turn hired a spy firm which was largely made up of ex-Secret Service operatives. And they were trying to figure out who Deep Chocolate was. And so they put a lot of the people on the Mars side under surveillance. They were pulling the phone records of the Mars consultants. They pulled all the phone numbers that the Mars lobbyists called from their lobbying office in Washington to figure out who they were talking to, who they knew. And they were listening in on conversations of Mars executives when they could follow them in public places.
The company that Nestle hired, Beckett Brown, got into some trouble later on. What was Mary Lou Sapone, their agent, found to be doing?
She was an interesting character. She was infiltrating anti-gun groups, and she was posing as a woman who was interested in anti-gun issues and had, I think, even been on the board of some of these groups at one point or another, and was attending all their meetings, gathering all the information, all the while under the guise of somebody who was really interested in the issue. Secretly, though, she was working for Beckett Brown, which was in turn working for the NRA, and they were passing anti-gun group information right back to their biggest opponents, the NRA, who are, of course, pro-gun.
Is this something that is done commonly?
It's relatively common. Yeah, these undercover infiltration operations happen on a fairly regular basis. It's very hard because they're so secret. It's very hard to say how frequently or how many times, but these undercover operations are sort of what these spy firms do.
Is this a fairly recent development? I mean, during the Cold War, I assume that most of the spying that went on was between nations. But some of these stories go back actually many decades.
Sure.
But when did detective work go from being a tracer of lost persons like Mr. Keene in the old radio series or people who were checking up on their spouses into something like this?
Well, there's always been both sort of offensive and defensive investigative work going on in the U.S. economy. Going back, you know, in my research, I traced it back to the Pinkertons back in the 1850s. Alan Pinkerton was a Scottish immigrant, a Chicago detective, and he formed the great private detective agency Pinkertons, which was deploying a number of undercover operatives throughout the corporate world at that time. They chased the Jesse James gang on behalf of some of the banks that the James gang had been robbing, hired the Pinkertons to go after and find out who these guys were and what they were up to. But they were also doing things like, after the Civil War, they investigated a group called the Molly Maguires, who were coal miners in the anthracite fields of Pennsylvania, mostly Irish immigrants, very tough life, very brutal conditions. And the Mollies were sort of a violent hybrid between a labor union and a street gang, basically. And the Pinkertons sent operatives in to join the Molly Maguires, and they spent years as undercover operatives at risk of their lives reporting back on all the operations these guys were doing against the mining firms. And they were, of course, working for the mining firms themselves.
Well, in that case, of course, that is something that the mining firms would want. But in the case of Jesse James, I would have thought that that was the job of the police.
Right. Well, in the late 19th century, there was no national police force in the United States. And so there was no capacity for policing the new brand of criminals, particularly on the railroads when they were doing the train robberies, train heists. The criminals could move hopscotch from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and these little county and town and city police forces were at a loss of how to track these guys across the country. The Pinkertons filled that gap in terms of policing against those people, but they were private detectives in the sense that they worked for private companies. They weren't really interested in crimes against individuals or people. They were interested in crimes against property and crimes against property where there was a big paying client.
My guest is Eamon Javers, who's a correspondent for Politico, where he covers the Obama White House and the economy. Earlier in his career, he was a Washington correspondent for Business Week magazine, also an on-air correspondent for CNBC. He's written a book called Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, which is published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, Alex Berenson discusses his latest thriller, The Midnight House, and then New Yorker writer Peter Hessler on his 7-year-long road trip around China. In case you didn't know, I'm now on Twitter. Find out what's on the show and go behind the scenes by following me at twitter.com/LeonardLopate. You can also find me on Facebook. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with an interview I did with Eamon Javers in February. He was here to discuss his book, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage. One of the things we talked about was a man named John Brody, and I asked him, how did he make his reputation as a spy?
He was the most legendary wiretapper of the middle of the 20th century. He operated here in Manhattan.
But that's illegal.
It is illegal, yes, and it caused a big scandal when Brody was captured. He had been involved in a number of wiretapping cases, was in and out of court throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s. In almost every case, he was involved in corporate wiretapping, wiretapping a company's phones on behalf of a rival. But he also did marital wiretapping and did a lot of other stuff.
How far did he go? Just putting a little tap on your phone? Or was he one of the people who put them in olives and martinis and stuff?
They didn't quite have that technology yet in the 50s. But Brody pulled off one of the greatest wiretapping scams of all time in 1955. He was captured because he and a couple of accomplices at the phone company had run central phone lines from the phone company office in Midtown Manhattan into an apartment he'd rented nearby. And they had the ability to record 10 different phones at a given time, recording equipment all set up in this wiretapping hidey hole, basically, in Midtown. They had 100,000 phones in Midtown Manhattan that they could have access to at any time just by flipping a switch, based on bribing people inside the phone company. And they were recording companies. They were recording law firms. They were recording art galleries.
And they were working for big companies like Pfizer.
They were.
What were they looking into for Pfizer?
Pfizer was involved in a pretty big dispute at the time. They were trying to get a sense of what the competitors were doing and when they were doing it. Anything you can gain by listening to the lawyer's phones, you know, who's involved in one of these corporate disputes, gives you an informational edge. They actually turned up so much information as they were turning it over to Pfizer. The Pfizer people pushed back and said, don't give us all of this. Just summarize some of it because it's too much. They were getting so much good stuff.
Did he go to jail?
Brody did go to jail several times and was sort of an unrepentant character. I mean, he was a big bruiser of a guy physically. And in all the pictures at the time, he's covered a lot in the newspapers, was always wearing a fedora and had a pretty stern growl on his face. And he was in and out of jail a lot. But he had a lot of high-powered political friends here in New York, and he was sort of unrepentant. He kept wiretapping. Every time he got out of jail, he was, you know, sort of start up at it again.
We've been talking about corporate spying and also spying on activist groups. But one of the legendary detectives you write about is Hal Lipsett, and he worked for Jim Jones, Reverend Jim Jones of the People's Temple.
He did, and that's something I have a tough time forgiving him for myself. I mean, I have a personal connection to the Jonestown saga. My father was a reporter who covered Jonestown in 1978. If you remember that massacre that they had, not only did more than 900 people commit suicide at Jonestown, but also they massacred a U.S. congressman and several reporters who were traveling with the congressman that same day. My father was on that airstrip and was shot in that exchange, wounded and survived. But Jim Jones was a particularly disgusting and evil person. Hal Lipsett, who's a private detective in San Francisco, sort of dismissed all that and said, you know, basically, I don't care about what he's doing. If there are allegations that he's imprisoning people or holding them against their will, he said the U.S. Army holds people against their will and forces them to do things they don't want to do. The Catholic Church, the same thing. You know, who am I to judge their beliefs? And when I read that about Lipsett, I really, you know, he was such a fascinating and intriguing character, but I really started to not like him as a writer writing about him.
What was he spying on?
Well, for Jones, what he was doing was he was teaching them security operations because he was involved in the early part of Jones's career when he was in California setting up his what later became a cult. It started out as sort of a Christian offshoot and had a lot of Christian followers and later became a much more dangerous and dark thing. But even early on, Jones was fairly paranoid, and he wanted some information from Lipset, who had a lot of Army training and detective security training, how to set up security perimeters around his facilities, how to check the people who are coming to visit him for weapons, what kind of security operation he should set up. So Lipset helped Jones sort of encourage that paranoia and, you know, was really unrepentant about it later in his life.
Talking about paranoia, Howard Hughes was famously private, but he also used a private spying company called Intertel. Why?
Yeah, Hughes is a fascinating character. I mean, if anybody has seen the movie Aviator, you know that he was this sort of completely crazy billionaire who controlled a multi-billion dollar corporate fortune, was in the oil business, was in the movie business, the aviation industry, defense contracting. But he had a fascination for intelligence, and he had a guy working for him named Robert Mayhew, who was a CIA veteran. And Mayhew was a legendary figure because not only did he run Howard Hughes's operations, but he was also a CIA contact. And Mayhew was involved in the attempts to assassinate Castro, and he was the connector between the CIA and the mafia when they tried to engage the mafia to whack Castro. All the while, working for Howard Hughes, who's running a huge defense contracting operation, Hughes loved this because knowing that Mayhew was plugged into this Castro assassination effort was a huge chip that he could deploy, and it gave him leverage over the federal government because he knew some of their deepest secrets.
Don't some of the current firms actually encourage CIA and FBI agents to moonlight?
Well, what I discovered in doing the research for the book, and we reported this last week on Politico.com, is that the CIA has a very little-known moonlighting policy where they actually allow active duty, that we're not talking about retired people who leave the service and go on to do something else. Active duty CIA officers are allowed to work in the private sector if they certify that it's not going to be a conflict of interest, fill out the appropriate paperwork, get approval from their bosses in the CIA. They're allowed to work in the private sector. We don't know a lot about this. The CIA confirmed the existence of this policy for me, but I don't know, and the CIA won't say, how many CIA officers are taking advantage of this policy at any given time.
Sounds conflict of interest to me at times. It could be anyway.
When we reported this last week, there was a sort of a little bit of a hue and cry on Capitol Hill, and the intelligence committees both said that they were going to look into it, and the director of National Intelligence was testifying on Capitol Hill last week. He said he also will look into it, trying to figure out whether this is an appropriate policy to have or not. Now, it depends. I mean, you know, it's possible that these are analysts and sort of academic types, and they're maybe teaching a college course on the side or something like that in their area of expertise. That probably wouldn't raise a lot of eyebrows, but it depends on where they're working and what they're doing.
Ayman Jaber's book is called Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage. It's published by Harper's Business. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Jules Krull is one of the more fascinating people you write about. And this guy's all over the place. He's on Wall Street. He uncovers Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos's business dealings. He works... He tracks down Saddam Hussein's fortune after the first Gulf War. He works for Boris Yeltsin. He works for Alan Stanford, the man who's been accused of running a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, the guy they call the Pirate of the Caribbean. Jules Krull is a legendary figure in this business, a private detective, got his start very early on in the 70s and built the firm Krull, which has sort of become, you know, iconic in this industry. I mean, lots of corporate folks will know Krull and Krull investigators and hire them for all kinds of disputes. If there's litigation, if there's a takeover, if there's some kind of hostile corporate activity going on, very frequently you can find Krull involved. Jules was the guy who founded the firm, and he's now left Krull, which still exists and is a powerful force unto itself. And Jules is now founding a new firm called K2. He's going to start a ratings agency.
Well, how did he wind up working for Boris Yeltsin?
Well, he was brought in after the fall of the Soviet Union. The Russians were concerned. The new democratic government of Russia was concerned that the money was fleeing Russian banks, and they weren't really sure where the assets were all going. And a lot of these companies were getting privatized and being sold to unknown shadowy figures, and there was some question of whether the mafia was able to take over key pieces of the Russian infrastructure, which, as we know later, you know, was largely the case. But Krull was asked by the Russian government, hired by the Russians, to investigate this. And I sat down and talked with Jules Krull about this. And he told me it was one of the more frustrating investigations of his entire career. And this is a guy who's investigated just about everything there is to investigate. He said because the Russian intelligence agencies assigned people to allegedly to cooperate with the Krull investigators and help them find who was who and what was what. But it became clear to Jules and the Krull team that, in fact, the Russian intelligence people were not helping this investigation. It was ordered by their own government, but were there to sort of monitor it and block it and steer it in a way that was very frustrating for Krull, and they ended up giving up. They were unsuccessful in finding much of what they thought was out there.
Well, it turns out that some KGB agents have benefited a lot from the transition.
Sure.
Including Vladimir Putin.
Sure. And Putin has famously said there is no such thing as an ex-KGB officer. Once KGB, always KGB. And a lot of those folks are key players in the Russian economy to this day. Krull was able to track a lot of these assets, but I think Jules concluded, and you'd have to ask him this, but I think he concluded at the end of the day that the Russian government backed off this investigation because they needed the KGB guys to prop up their government, and they couldn't afford to embarrass them with all the embezzlement and whatnot that they were finding.
This kind of work has been done for hedge funds. Why hedge funds?
Well, one of the firms that I write about in the book is a Boston-based firm called Business Intelligence Advisors, which is founded by several ex-CIA operatives.
And they are using some of those moonlighting CIA officers.
They have used them in the past, yes. I was able to confirm that. They say they haven't used any moonlighting active duty CIA officers in, quote, some time, unquote. So we don't know exactly when that process stopped. But they certainly employ lots of former CIA officers to this day, including long-term 20, 25-year veteran CIA interrogators. And BIA has developed a strategy which is really fascinating called deception detection. And what they're using are both psychological and physiological markers to see if they can tell just by sitting across from somebody looking at them whether they're lying or not. But word choice, whether they're scratching their face, shifting their anchor points, they talk about as if they lean forward or back suddenly in their chair.
A lot of blinking.
All these things are things that they're looking for. They have a whole write-up that they do of things to watch for to tell if somebody's lying. And if you see all these indicators at once around a particular statement, then as the interrogator, you go back to that statement, you go back to that fact, and you pull on that a little bit more. Well, why you don't seem comfortable about the X issue. Why is that? Tell me a little bit more about that. And what they're doing is they're selling this deception detection service now into the private sector. They're selling it to hedge funds and financial firms, and they're listening in on corporate earnings calls. So companies have these classic capitalistic ritual. They have a quarterly earnings conference call where they talk to Wall Street analysts about how they did last quarter, what they're likely to do next quarter, sales are up or down or sideways or what have you. The CIA veteran interrogators and the other people they've trained over at BIA are now listening in on those calls, listening to see if the CEO seems to be misleading or uncomfortable about certain earnings projections, and then using that to follow up with tougher questions.
Since they have that capability, it's surprising that the CIA was so connected to torture. They could have just probably told with a spy whether somebody who they suspected of being an Al-Qaeda member was or was not.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm told that some of the veteran CIA interrogators were really appalled by the waterboarding and all the stuff that went on, because their training tells them exactly the opposite, that in fact you can get a lot more information by this very subtle but very thorough interrogation than you can by any kind of torture, where a person will say just about anything to make the pain stop.
A listener, Hugh in Brooklyn, wonders how is the work that these people are doing any different from the data mining that corporations are doing on us?
Well, I think,
and another listener, to follow that up, says, wants to know how we can know if we're being spied on by a Wall Street firm or a TV network, for that matter.
Well, you can't. I mean, in many cases. I mean, a lot of this surveillance that's done is very, very sophisticated and very powerful. And, the average person would have, very limited ability to tell that it's actually going on.
And now they're using satellite technology. How did they gain access to satellite technology?
Well, satellites are available in the private sector, and they have been for a couple of decades now. And one of the things that I write about in the book that was really fascinating to me is the degree to which commodities traders on Wall Street are now using satellites to monitor commodities. You know, if you're buying corn futures or wheat futures, you need to know what the crop yields are. And using these infrared satellites, and they hire, you know, all the satellite jockeys out of the intel services and the military, who are the guys who have the experience to actually fly these things, they can look at the wheat crop in Kazakhstan and tell you whether there's been a flood that would damage a certain amount of the crop or insects have gotten to it. And they can tell you what the yield is going to be likely for that year, therefore what the price is going to be. And if they know that in advance, they can, you know, give a shellacking to their competitors.
Doesn't Walmart use satellites to get information about its own company?
I was told by a company called GeoEye, which is a private satellite operator in Northern Virginia, that Walmart has been a client of theirs. And what Walmart has done is they've looked at their own stores, and they're trying to figure out the physical properties of a store that really generates a lot of sales. So where is it in relation to the nearest high school? Where is it in relation to the highway? How is the parking lot set up? Does the front door face north, east, south, or west? And they aggregate all that data and try to figure out the optimal, you know, location and situation for a Walmart store.
Is there any evidence that these high-powered corporate intelligence firms spy on each other?
Oh, absolutely they do. In the case that I detail in the very first chapter of the book, I'm told that there were squadrons of spy firms on both sides of this sort of epic legal and financial battle between two Russian oligarchs that spanned the world for several years. And the spy firms were definitely spying on each other to the point where they were running full-scale intelligence surveillance strategies to make sure that they themselves weren't being tailed while they were tailing other people. And it's very funny because I was in London, which is one of the sort of crossroads of this industry, interviewing some of the British ex-special forces guys who do this surveillance work. And they say the industry is relatively small. They frequently know the guys who are tailing them while they're tailing that guy's client. So it's a real cat and mouse.
There's a wonderful classic film called The Conversation by Francis Ford Coppola.
I watched it.
And that deals with this in an earlier time. It must look awfully crude to the current practitioners.
Right, it really does. I mean, what they can do now is astonishing. The Brits were telling me about these laser microphones that they use, in which they can stand off from a target about a kilometer away and put an invisible laser dot on a window. And from a kilometer away, when you and I are sitting in this room here and there's a window out to the street, when we talk, the glass vibrates ever so slightly with the audio of our voice. The laser picks that up, translates it back into audio, and they can record the conversation from a kilometer away from the office building.
Of course, they could just turn on the radio and record it right from that. As far as this,
well, you're an overt operative. You're not a covert operative.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Eamon Javers. His book, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, published by Harper. And now you go back to writing about the president and the economy?
Yeah, something a little less complicated.
Are you at all discouraged by what's going on in Washington?
Well, I think, you know, what the biggest question right now for Barack Obama is, how does he handle these declining poll ratings, the loss that they took in Massachusetts? How does he regain the footing for his presidency that he needs in order to deliver some economic results before this very important midterm election in November? That's a very dicey time for the president.
It is kind of shocking that if you have a 9-member majority, although 8 now that Murtha has died, but still, when you have what seems like a comfortable majority, it's not a majority.
Right. I mean, you need 60 votes to get anything done in the United States Senate. That's been the bane of everyone's existence for a long time. It's even more so now that the filibuster is used so commonly. And it's really been a struggle for the Obama administration to get any of their major legislative initiatives done, even in a Congress where they have huge majorities. Very frustrating for them.
Well, maybe they should get some of these corporate spies to find out what the Republicans are thinking. The Republicans can do the same thing with the Democrats.
Well, there are political oppo guys who do that already. I mean, there's a lot of that in Washington, too. I mean, there's a long tradition of spying on each other to gather dirt, you know, in Washington.
We saw that with Watergate. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was fun.
Up next, New York Times reporter Alex Berenson discusses his novel, The Midnight House, and his return of CIA agent John Wells to investigate who's killing CIA agents in Poland. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.